What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. We're rejoining our conversation for this episode with Victoria Smith, author of Hags, The Demonization of Middle-Aged Women, Sonia Soda, Chief Leader Writer at The Observer and regular Guardian columnist, and Hadley Freeman, staff writer at The Sunday Times and author of Good Girls, Story and Study of Anorexia. They were live on stage at the Tabernacle in London recently to discuss the themes of Victoria's book, Hags, and its surrounding issues, what does it mean to be middle-aged and a woman in 2024? This is a conversation in three parts. If you haven't caught part one yet, just jump back an episode and get up to speed. And if you want to hear even more of what is a great conversation, you can get our exclusive members-only part three installment by becoming a member of Intelligence Squared. Just head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now, let's join Hadley Freeman and fellow writers Victoria Smith and Sonia Soda discussing one of society's taboo topics that leaves little to the imagination.
Well, in a similar way, connected to that, about how things become politicized and male sexual entitlement, pornography, something that I've never understood the appeal of. But to say that makes you sound like, as someone called me on Twitter the other day, a dried up, joyless old hag. Yes.
It's one of those things they think is an insult.
I know. I'm just like, oh, amazing. And what I find fascinating is that we're at this period in time where women are hyper-conscious about, you know, microaggressions and being kind and consent and all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, it's just a general given that everyone is watching incredibly violent porn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where do you think, why are we stuck in these two extremes?
I think I was reading Polly Barton's pornography and oral history, mm-hmm. and she's interviewed 20 people about their experiences with pornography. And actually, that was really kind of illuminating, because there were two interviews with women, I think, in their 20s and 30s, where I think one of them described, like, finding on her partner's computer that he'd been watching gang rape scenes. Ew. and you know, really horrible stuff. But she was kind of saying, oh, but, you know, I don't want to get into, like, the sex-phobic second-wave position, because that was really bad, and I think, you know, it becomes a bit... I think she mentions it becomes a bit fascist-adjacent, and he gets a bit turfy if you're criticising... And it's this kind of, like... They're telling themselves, I mustn't judge, even... And it's this kind of, I must be kind to the idea of this sexual liberalism, but it's withholding empathy from, actually, the people who are in these videos, and the message... And it's this... It's really been sold to... There's a message that being kind is not being judgmental, mm. and therefore you must be okay with these things. They're actually really horrible. And I used to watch like what was sold as feminist mm. porn, and then I suddenly thought, I don't fully know the background of these people, even if it's like nice scenarios, and it's not like, you know, they're like consensual storylines. I just suddenly struck me as getting off on like people enacting these things, and you just don't know the background. And it suddenly struck me as really, really disturbing. But that's meant to be a terrible opinion that makes you a bad person who's denying people agency.
You are repressed or something. I just think, why don't people have imaginations? Like, why? Yeah. Don't you want to remember?
It's really weird that it's kind of like almost this human right. That it's like it would be a terrible society if we. But yeah, you can think.
You can use your own mind. Yeah. The kindness thing is so funny because I find that be kind always means be kind to men.
Yes.
So there was that whole thing with Rupert Grint saying after he slagged off J.K. Rowling, the woman to whom he owes his entire life, I just want some kindness out there. And I remember when we first started talking about this, I think it was like you and me really in the early days, Victoria, and also Helen, Lewis, and Sarah. And you would get these men online telling us to just be kind.
Yeah.
How dare we say that males shouldn't be on women's sports team or whatever. We need to be kind. You think, but who are you being, like, who's being kind to the other girls on the sports team? It's somehow be kind to men. It's become a great hashtag for men.
And I think there's also this way in which girls are conditioned to be kind and
of course
compassionate and giving. And there are all these kind of different narratives that are used to promote it, sort of either religious ones that say that women are just helpmeets and second, or we've had sort of the neuroscience ones that say that women are just naturally empathetic and men are kind of systemized. Sorry, I've just,
really.
And then you have this kind of social justice one that it doesn't acknowledge that men and women aren't at the same starting point. Like women are already giving a lot of kindness, they're already paying a lot of them. You can spend a lot of your time tiptoeing around male feelings and it's just not noticed. All that's noticed is when you fail to cater, when you say something a bit out of line. And, you know, it's like the housework and, like, no one notices you're doing it until it's not done. And it's that kind of... All the kindness that women deliver sort of disappears down a black hole. But it's always noticed when it's not there. And I think with the sex and gender debate... Women have been really kind. You know, one of the things, like, women decided, okay, you don't like being called men, we'll just use the word male. And then it's like, no, you're not using male.
You'll literally be sacked from the BBC.
And it's just like, well, what words can... Well, you can't have any words. And it's kind of...
I think you've got to be really suspicious of people who sort of entreat others to be kind as well. Because when I think when you look at some of the people doing this, they're some of the nastiest people out there. And there is a particular brand of left-wing identitarian politics that is incredibly nasty, that divides the world into good and evil. If you think like me, you're good. If you disagree with me, you're evil. Being kind is thinking exactly like me. It's actually really harmful and nasty and toxic. And some of those people are the worst people online. So,
indeed.
You know,
always.
You have to treat them with suspicion, I would say.
And it's interesting about the women who they do think are kind. I mean, it's always the young women and the women who are basically saying what they want, but the men are already
the
saying.
The women who agree with them.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it sort of reminds me of kind of, I don't know, it's... If you see a husband who's like treating his wife badly, and he'll go like, the wife doesn't mind, she finds it funny, she finds it funny. You know, this is kind of like, my mates
so
don't,
awful.
I've got female friends, they don't find I'm sexist kind of thing. And it's maybe they can't, they know how you treat women who disagree with you. But it's also this kind of, we're on the right side of history, we all have the right opinions. It doesn't seem to acknowledge change and that your opinions change as you go through life. It has this whole like, there's this tranche of women who have the bad opinions and they'll die soon and they'll never exist again. They'll never be women who really think the female body and the female life cycle are important and care about safeguarding again. They'll just disappear off the planet and then no one, women will disagree
with us
again.
Yeah, they'll die out. Those views are
dying
out.
Even though there are plenty of young women who do disagree with...
Of course. I love seeing
it. And do want to form connections across generations as well.
And also, they know that older women have gone through things they haven't gone through yet. I mean, it made me laugh so much when a certain high-profile, progressive, left-wing male columnist wrote online that TERF views are dying out. And I was like, as long as there are women, there's going to be women who realize that women have bodies. I think it was Helen Lewis who said at some point that it's so interesting when males say they want to be a woman, it means, you know, have long hair and heels and dresses. It never means take a pay cut and don't get to say anything in meetings.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the menopause, that great part of haggishness. I mean, people keep saying no one's talking about it. As far as I can tell, every single person is talking about it, and they all have podcasts about it too. And I'm not criticizing. I mean, that is just a fact. Is it now being treated as a disease? Should we go back to looking at it as just part of the female experience?
I think it's one of those things that's really difficult to kind of get right, because we've got this culture that has been so, like Caroline Criado Perez wrote about in Invisible Women, that is so focused on the male body as the default body, and like women's bodies are just these inconvenient deviations, even though our bodies are the ones that create all the people. And it's I think we've had, like, with periods and with pregnancy, these things have been treated as, oh, they're workplace inconveniences, they get in the way. And whenever women have fought for accommodations to be made, but then there's always this threat, you know, if we're going to take into account that you've not got a male body, you'll be seen as a liability. And I feel that happens with menopause as well, this kind of... I think, was it a train company with those menopause bags?
Oh, my God.
That they issued that were, like, with...
embarrassing.
I can't remember. It was some really horrible puns on, like, if you're losing your temper, you know, it's a paperclip to help you hold
so
it all together
because, oh,
you know, you're going a bit mad. You know, it was one of those things that it was really enraging, but like the Karen thing, you can't get enraged about it because then you're exemplifying.
You're probably going through the menopause if you're angry about it.
And I feel that can't let us be scared of talking about it or be scared of wanting it to get more acknowledgement. Because I do find it, like, now that we're hearing so many conversations about it, quite amazing that, like, when I was younger, obviously so many older women were going through this in silence. Mm-hmm. And I can remember kind of my mum occasionally mentioning things and me thinking, oh my God, that sounds horrendous.
That's disgusting.
But then, like, then she'd just carry on. And it's that, I think that's quite horrible, actually, that a lot of women were sort of going through stuff alone.
Yeah, but also, don't you think that there is a tendency sometimes of women to have not listened to women before them? Because I remember watching TVAM, like, at breakfast before school, and Claire Rayner was on talking about the menopause, and, like, my mum had a Miriam Stoppard book about the menopause. I mean, people were talking out there.
Yeah.
It wasn't on podcasts, because podcasts didn't exist. But there is something in women where, it's like when people, you know, when a female journalist has a baby and then writes a column about the baby because no one else has had a baby ever before. Yeah. And, like, fair play, it is astonishing when it happens. But also you think, this is because you didn't listen to older women before because you thought they were naff and embarrassing.
Yeah, basically. I think that's the kind of experience I had when reading Adrienne Rich, thinking, oh my God, she saw all the thoughts already that I thought. Like, and I think, you know, and I kind of got into writing through mummy blogging, and I think there was a kind of drive, certainly in me, as wanting to write about... Yeah, I did write quite a lot about my kids when they were... And it was this kind of like...
I mean, that's what's in your head. I mean, that's fair enough.
But it's also this kind of like, I'm going to have this blog that shows I'm not like all the boring mummies. I'm going to have strong opinions. And of course, like, no, all the mummy bloggers are like that because because women all have... You don't become someone who just stops having opinions and a complex inner life because you've had children. That's just like the kind of thing.
But that's what a Karen would say. Have you written about the employment rights around menopause?
I have. I think it's so I have mixed feelings about it, and I think a lot of women do. It's a tricky one because you want there to be more conversation about it because the menopause has real world impacts on women, and actually there's massive you know, women are not able to access the medical treatment that they need. We know that. Like, there is, you know, a lack of supply of HRT. There are too many GPs who are reluctant to prescribe HRT, who still buy into some of the myths around it. So, there is a lot to talk about. Although I think probably the way that employment law is structured at the moment, you know, if you are suffering the ill effects of menopause, it is kind of covered in your existing legal rights. But so there is a big education drive to do with employers and with medical professionals. So actually, because, you know, that's one of the big things. Can women access the medical treatment that for not all women, but for many women, is effective at alleviating symptoms? But the problem is also, the more you talk about it, the more you play into these notions that older women are useless in the workplace. Yeah. And, you know, it's been such a revelation to me in the last 5 years, particularly talking about sex and gender. looking at the marginalisation of women as they get older in the workplace totally. And the intersection of misogyny and ageism. Like, I mean, it's been, I've been shocked the last 4 or 5 years. I've really seen the way women, predominantly middle-aged and older women in the workplace who say inconvenient things are sidelined. And so you really don't want to, so it's challenging because you've got to talk about it, but at the same time, you have to shift these societal perceptions that are really, like, ageism does not affect men and women equally. I mean, you know, it's such an obvious point to make. It's when you make brilliantly in your book, but it disproportionately affects women. So we have to also challenge those societal perceptions, and that is really, really difficult. And I feel complicit in the societal perceptions because, you know, I don't like my signs of aging. I dye my greys out, like, you know, and so I'm it's like I'm almost part of the problem. And how much of that is me making a choice, and how much of that is what society imposed on me? But all I know is I hate my greys, and I'm not going to like not dye them out. So it's, I feel very conflicted about it because I want us to be talking about it, but at the same time, I just don't want us to be. Like, I don't want to give more grist to the men in the workplace and other women in the workplace who sort of think, well, you know, oh, menopause brain, that's a thing. All women go dappy after the age of 50 or something. It's a really fine line to tread, I think, that I feel conflicted about.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And a fine line also to not pathologize the female experience.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. like there is a lot of, there are a lot of doomy columns or books about how, what a nightmare it is to have a baby, for example. And okay, it is. I mean, I speak as one who had two massive twins, for example. And, you know, it's not like, I've had more pleasant experiences than giving birth to them. But obviously, very happy. But this idea of demonizing the female experience, I think then plays into the kind of idea that being a woman is horrible and disgusting, and therefore makes younger women want to distance themselves from older women. But why do you think younger women are so keen to join in on the demonization of middle-aged women? None of the young women here, obviously, I say.
I think, certainly from my perspective, I think it was fear of kind of seeing what their status was and how other people treated older women. You know, I mean, sort of, you know, my own background was kind of middle class, where quite right-wing, and where it was kind of a bit of a status thing to have a wife who wasn't in paid employment, and it's this kind of like, and you know, your job is to kind of run the household and do, and I just kind of remember looking at this when I was younger and thinking, I'm not going to run around after other people, I'm going to be like the man. I really wanted to, because it looked more interesting being a man. It looked more, you know, you were out in public space more. Your opinions were valued more. You know, I think a phrase that I'd often hear growing up was, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So if you weren't earning money, you didn't have value. And, you know, and there is, the pay gap is at its biggest when women are in their 50s. It's kind of always growing because there's this cumulative falling behind. And I think identifying with the male life cycle is quite attractive because they're not having these periods of being edged out, or they're not falling behind, and they're not having their opinions trashed once they get to a certain age. And I think that made me certainly quite worried about aging and about being female, just this idea that... I do think sometimes we don't talk enough about the way in which we do internalise the idea that being female is being inferior, and you've got to find a way to overcome
it. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And also your role is to make men feel good.
Yeah. And that internalised misogyny, I mean, it's in all of us. It's not just in men. And again, it's another kind of really obvious thing to say, but, you know, it's a product of some of these really harmful sex stereotypes that, you know, that children start picking up when they're very, very young. And I do believe that, you know, and it absolutely does not apply to all younger women at all. But there is a bit of a generational split in feminism, and I think that is a product of internalised misogyny. And it's not kind of, I think it's kind of unhelpful to kind of blame people for it, because like, I think I've become more aware of my own internalised misogyny as I've got older and a bit wiser in terms of kind of what to do with it and kind of being aware that it's there. But it really does live within us all, I think.
And now, 8 o'clock, I'm going to open the floor up to questions. Now, there are ushers going around with microphones. And if you are watching online, you can ask questions by putting them in the Q&A tab on the right-hand side of the screen. And do feel free to add your name and the place you're tuning in from. We already have a question from online from Mel, going back to something that Victoria was talking about earlier. Often, father and daughter look down on the mother together. They exchange meaningful glances when she misses a point. They agree that she is not bright as they are and cannot reason as they do. This collusion does not save the daughter from the mother's fate. Any comments about what the mother's fate might be?
God, I think I have read that quote, and it struck me as really, really apt. And it actually kind of it reminded me actually of my grandmother, because I can remember when I went to university, she used to talk quite a lot about how she'd have loved to go to university, and she'd have loved to read, and she'd have loved to write, and she liked writing poetry. And there was a bit of me that thought, no, this is my stuff. Like, you're just grandma. This is, you know, I got into university off my own back, which actually, I went to a college that not even my mum could have got into because it excluded women until 1980. So, but I didn't kind of appreciate these kind of things. I was kind of like, this is my generation of women are just... And I think, I had an awareness that many of the rights that my generation of women had had been won by women of previous generations who didn't have them. But there was this sense that, therefore, we'll be better women, we'll be more like the men. Mm. And I think identifying with the father rather than the mother is kind of... sorry, I was trying to look at what the... the it was kind of what the mother's fate will be.
Yeah.
I think often, like, women come to... I think I can imagine the mother in that scenario eventually reaching a point when her daughter is actually identifying more with her. But it takes too long,
yeah,
really.
I would say many weekends away with her girlfriends is what I would advise for that mother.
Yeah.
And I think the difference about aging as a form of discrimination as well is there is a fear there, not of the other, as there is with some types of discrimination, but a fear of what yourself will become.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's what makes it so different. And I think there's a lot, and you know, I used to sort of feel this way, I think, as a young woman, you'd sort of be like, well, their generation didn't get it quite right, but we'll conquer. We'll be the ones who do it.
Yeah.
And then by the time you're in your mid-30s, you're like, oh.
Is there anyone on the floor? Yes, someone right there, I think. Yep.
Hi. I just wanted to ask to put a kind of positive spin on what we've been talking about and ask whether or not you think part of the reason why there's been such a massive upsurge in, like, very public misogyny might be because our generation of women are so unprepared to put up with it.
Victoria?
I think our generation of women has been really provoked by, I think, particularly issues to do with pornography and sex and gender and the way these debates have gone, and have really started to organise and in a really, I'd say in a really positive way, and I think in a way that is quite, I do find it quite inspiring that I think that it's, I don't know, I'd say 10 years ago it was...
Well, we can find each other now online.
There was a lot of talk about feminism, but I don't think it's really getting to the roots of things in the way that it is now.
Yeah.
I think a lot of middle-aged women now are really talking about the real kind of gritty fundamentals of feminism and where misogyny starts from, how it relates to the body, how it relates to what men want from women, and all these kinds of issues that I think that maybe we were quiet about.
Or also just making us think more. Like, I remember when there first started to be arguments about sex and gender, and, you know, I would see men and some women online saying, oh, these feminists, they're just like these body essentialists, which is what the feminists were arguing against. They're reducing women to their body. And I think you wrote, Victoria, somewhere where you said, well, no, feminists are about, you know, decoupling qualities associated with the female body, whether it's femininity and passivity, but, you know, you are still of the body. And actually, the whole gender movement is about associating those qualities with whatever a woman is, like the body becomes irrelevant. And just sort of seeing women talking about these things online has made me much more aware of things that I just took for granted before.
I think we've been really forced to think about it, because I think a lot of the misogyny is right out there in primary colours, and women aren't really going to sit back and take it.
Also, I keep seeing, it first started some article in The Independent, some mad article about TERFs, and I've seen it repeated since in other articles, talking about women talking on WhatsApp groups as though this is like some evil coven in the woods.
Oh God, I've seen, do you know what really gets me? Yeah. The criticism of Mumsnet, it is hypocritical. It's like, if you look for the worst stuff on Mumsnet, and you know, some of it may be bad, some of it may not be that bad, but to judge a whole platform by that and all the women on it, it's so sexist. And it's like, you see these people on Twitter criticising Mumsnet, and it's like, I'm not judging you by the worst of Twitter, because I have the intellectual capacity to understand it is a platform, and not everyone on the platform signs up to absolutely... It is the sexism latent in the criticism of Mumsnet is rank. And the people who talk about the radicalisation of women on Mumsnet, it's like, Mum's Net is less radicalisation than radicalising than Twitter, and you're on Twitter and you're moaning about it on Twitter. I mean, come on.
But it's also just like, it's Mum's Net for women who've just had babies. Like, they are going to be aware of the interplay between the body and themselves. Like, if anyone's aware of how women are disproportionately affected by sexism and how much it has to do with their female bodies, it's going to be the women on Mum's Net. So obviously they're talking about this stuff.
I think women do learn a lot on Mum's Net through talking. Mm. I think that is a kind of disturb. You know, I think there's this sort of twin way of trying to attack it, as in, like, on the one hand, oh, it's just these silly middle-class mummies just going on about what the best pram is.
Except,
oh, but they're also like, they're really evil fascists.
And,
but it's actually, it's women talking about their experiences and learning from one another, and actually some of it's really, it's just really valuable.
And
it's
women with all sorts of moderated
knowledge.
And Twitter isn't.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know.
And also, you know, these are women who are generally stuck at home all day on maternity leave or looking after the children while the men are out in the world doing things. So be glad that they're doing something, because if I was, you know, when I was on maternity leave, I went fully bonkers. So good for them that they're online talking to each other, is what I say to the women on Mum's Net. Someone over there, right there.
As a younger woman, I want to ask, how do we warn younger women successfully?
I think one thing I find really quite unpleasant is, you know, when younger women who disagree with older women about particular debates get called handmaidens or dick pandering and those kind of insults. They really kind of, I find, that's so unhelpful, and I think it's really important to kind of build bridges between women. But it is really difficult, because when I was writing the book, there was this sense in myself, like, how would younger me have seen this? And I think, and I found it as well, sort of with anorexia, I've often found that people, if they've known someone who's got anorexia, they've said, like, oh, you recovered. What should you say to them? And it's kind of like, I know exactly how I would have received anything I could say. I would have just thought, that's a load of rubbish.
Yes.
So I do find it really difficult, because it's also this kind of, you're in this whole culture that sends all these messages that are so negative about aging. And it is quite frightening when you think, oh, that's going to be my fate if I don't kind of, if I don't distance myself and disidentify from these other women. So I think I think it has to be quite incremental. I don't think necessarily there is one message that we can send each other, but I think activism together and also working together on issues where we can agree is important as well.
So Sonia is the youngest one up here. How should we reach down to
people? I mean, marginally youngest, I think. you pit me by a few years, Hadley. I totally agree with Victoria that I think anyone involved in these conversations needs to do their best to depolarise them and to take the heat out of them. So terms like handmaiden I find actually quite sexist in and of themselves. Yeah. And I agree with you, they're completely unhelpful. I think it is about conversations, and also it's definitely, although I think there is a generational split in feminism that I think you write about so brilliantly in the book, Victoria, it isn't all pervasive.
No.
And some of the, you know, like I've had conversations with women who are teenagers and men who are teenagers. Like, you know, like I had dinner with my friends last night, and, you know, she's got a 15 and a 13-year-old boy, and we were talking about some of these issues around sex and gender, because she talks to them, and it's so energising when you realise that there are young people who are so much smarter than you would have been at that age. They really get these issues. So, and I think it can actually be really difficult for young women in particular to... It's much easier for people in our generation to come up with the unpopular views. I think there's lots of younger women who might have these views, but they're so much more isolated than we are. So I think, you know, so I think for women who might agree with us already, it's about, making sure that people can have those conversations and making sure that you're mixing in groups of women that are intergenerational, which sounds really basic, but I think helps. But I think it is about trying to depolarize it as much as possible when it comes to younger women who disagree with you about issues like, you know, aging or the menopause or sex and gender, pornography, surrogacy, You know, these are going to be the really big ones, I think. I mean, they are the big ones already, so yeah.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Hall. If you'd like even more of that conversation, you can listen to our Members Only Part 3, featuring an extended audience Q&A right now by heading over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. I've been Connor Boyle. Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared.